Aisha, and I'm a former host of Mocha Single Mothers by Choice, or SMCs. Like you, as an SMC, I decided to become a mother knowing I'd be the sole care provider and parent for my children, at least at the outset. The Mocha stood for Black, so I'm using the word Black, and I'll be discussing being a single mother by choice from a Black woman's lens. You'll connect with all the interesting and fun things about this non-traditional path, like discussing which sperm to use and some hard truths about fertility and the realities of dating as a single mother who doesn't have a co-parent to rely on occasionally, and what it's actually like to parent as an S&C. This is the Black Single Mothers by Choice podcast. Have a wonderful guest host with us this morning. But before we ask our guest host to introduce themselves, I did want to do a little bit of a PSA. So since the starting of our podcast, Hera and I have been getting people reaching out in various forms and and this season we really wanted to make sure that the people we choose to talk to are people who not just respect our perspectives as Black SMCs, but also seek to engage us in a meaningful and thoughtful way. And so our guest hosts here and throughout the rest of the season have done that. I had the opportunity to sit down and talk to Rosanna Hertz as I was trying for my second child. And your book was real instrumental to getting my head around just the different ways to do SMC. And so this is another wonderful opportunity. And my heart is warm just being able to talk with you and share your knowledge and experience with our audience.
Thank you for that really heartwarming and lovely introduction from both of you. I'm a professor of sociology and women's and gender studies at Wellesley College, where I chair the Women's and Gender Studies department. I'm a family sociologist by training, but for the past 25 years, I focused on the emergence of new family forms and how they are expanding our understanding of kinship. And so during the mid-1990s, I began studying new families, women with jobs, careers, economic independence, who felt that motherhood was missing. And most recently, I've been studying unprecedented families formed by sperm donor siblings. In this new work, about the sperm donor siblings called Random Families, I include the voices of donor-conceived children ages 10 and up, some of their donors and, of course, their parents. I've also written articles on the regulatory systems in the EU and border crossing for reproductive health to Spain, and I continue to research and write about families created through donor, sperm, egg, or both. So thank you.
No, thank you. Thank you. So I'm excited because we're going to touch on both of your books, Random Families and Single by Choice, Single by Chance, Mothers by Choice. But first, I want to start with how you came to learn the SMC community, the SMC space, the SMC people.
Sure. So it was the mid-1990s. Picture this. It's an interesting story. And if you recall, Bill Clinton was newly elected, and one of his first acts was around teenagers having babies and the reform of the welfare system. And the problem in America was at that point in time, when you think about it today, was about teen moms and trying to stop women from becoming teen moms. So I was reading the information and really the newspapers. And I also at the same time like to read a strange combination of things. I like to read demography reports for fun. And I also like to read ads in newspapers, which is a bizarre thing. Scanning these demographic reports around single mothers, and I realized that 50% of the women who are single, never married, and have children are not teen mothers, but they're older. And so I wanted to know more about who these women were, because they certainly were not the focus of either Bill Clinton or, if you recall, Dan Quayle at that moment. And so around, or who was earlier, actually. So around that same time, I'm also reading in my hometown newspaper an ad that came out, and it read, and I'm quoting this, "Are you interested in becoming a single mom? Call this number." And I thought, this is interesting. Intentional motherhood, not these accidentally pregnant teen mothers. So I, of course, called the number. That's who I am, too. And it was a local SMC group. So I told them that I wasn't a single mom, I had a very young child, and I really wanted to know all about what they were doing and could I attend their meetings. So they discussed it with their membership and they said, sure, you could come to our meeting. So I attended for a year the meetings of the thinkers, the triers, and also SMCs with children. And I still check in with the local community. I'm grateful to that community for allowing me into their lives. So it was a homogenous group insofar as the vast majority were white women and they were older, which is important. They were like 38, let's say the average age. And the issue was they couldn't find a partner. They weren't all straight. There was a mix of women there. And they were trying various different routes. They were all middle class or upper middle class is how I would describe them. And that's changed since that point in time. All of those things have changed. I think that Black women never put the label on it. Mm-hmm. And I think that, first of all, this meeting occurred in a church basement in a working class town. And it still meets in that same church.
All children are a blessing. Anyway. Yeah.
Very good.
Go back to your original question about do Black women advertise it or just not put a label on it? How many of us have not had the conversation, regardless of socioeconomic level, when you get to like your mid to late 20s, like if we're not married or don't have kids, right? And it's like formalizing that conversation where it's like to a male friend, if neither one of us are married, by the time we hit 30, right? 30, why don't we have a child together, right? And so it's the formalization, because even some of the people that we have seen, I would say almost in the last 4 weeks, join our space will say, I used to know a donor friend who was a friend, right? And I'm raising the child as an SMC. We have an agreement in place. So it is almost like they've already gone through the process of formalizing that, hey, if by 30, we don't have kids, right? And so it's that formalizing that informal conversation. And now on the back end, putting a name on it because you didn't even know that a name existed.
I would totally agree with what you're saying. The other thing is, remember, the 90s, there was no internet. Mm-hmm. So you couldn't just Google single mothers by choice or single moms and how to do it or whatever. It's like totally a different period we're living in. Also, in the research, Single by Chance, Mothers by Choice, it was easier for me to find women of color who were adopting children, primarily out of the domestic system. And it was also easier for me to find what I called in that book, women who chanced pregnancy. It was harder to locate women who conceived using commercial banks, sperm banks, or known donors. But I'm sure that they existed. It's like, how do you tap into certain communities, which has always been a problem for social science researchers. Thank you very much for bringing the conversation back to that, because what's interesting is it's around these ideas of these milestones, like I'm not, I'm not married by a certain date, what am I going to do? Or it could be finishing a degree or a promotion at work or having a certain set amount of money in the bank, or it could be my birthday. Exactly. And also the catalytic event could be something that's really sad, which is a death in the family. And saying, look, I can't postpone this any longer. My parents would have welcomed this child and I feel badly. Or it could be medical intervention, endometriosis, fibroids, and the doctor says, listen, you shouldn't be waiting any longer to get pregnant.
Cancer.
Or right. Cancer.
My catalytic event spanned like 10 years. So I came to the SMC path 4 or 5 years post-divorce, right? So I was married. I was at the precipice of having it all, the love, the marriage, the house, didn't have the dog yet, but was trending onto the conversations about kids. And it just so happened that my partner and I were not aligned about it. So after 10 years, so you could basically say I knew I wanted to be a mom from very early on. And then my divorce happened just as I was 29. And so like processing the divorce, getting back out there and dating, and then deciding what my next steps were, I got to the point where it's just like, yeah, I need to do something about this if I want to have kids. And so I went through all of the different variations of how to go about doing this. And then my very religious stepmother was like, why don't you just have a baby? Go get yourself a sperm donor. And I was just like, what? Is the church okay with that? But so that was like opening the door. But really, I spent probably 4 or 5 years in the thinking and the thinking phase, because I needed to do this last trip. I needed to get my heart. I needed to do one last chance to see if I identify as social dad. And then I got on the path. So for me, it wasn't a cataclysmic event per se. It was a cataclysmic kind of
phase in my life where I needed to hurry up and get myself there. But yeah, it is really interesting to hear the different triggers for women.
So what's so interesting is, no, I've just heard that the time frames are at younger ages as major shift going on, and it's much more global than we had ever thought. And I want to say the final thing is, you talk about, how does the church respond to this? Did I'm going to tell my family I'm doing this way? So one of the distinguishing features is this idea that SMCs need to get permission almost from family members or from other people, which I have never put in print, but it's interesting to think about. Married couples don't get permission, but the critical issue here is, with the permission, it's really saying, listen, I'm not going to rush to the altar to just marry any person. And I'm willing to say, what I'm really doing here is reversing the nursery rhyme, first comes love, then comes marriage, then comes baby in the baby carriage. So it's not like I'm opposed to a partnership or raising a kid with a partner. It's that I need to do this first.
Right.
And I'm going to take control of my life, and I have agency as a woman.
So I will say, picking up from that, the whole family piece is that, yeah, I was one of the people who, my parents are deceased, so I didn't have to have that parental approval. So I just floated it out there to my sisters who are my peers. And it's really, I'm just giving you an FYI, there's going to be additional little people at the Thanksgiving table. But what I found was that, whereas my immediate family, yeah, it was nice to have, but then out of donor conception came this whole other family. Like, I had a donor sibling, sister mom, that I reached out to, and it was all of the awkwardness of first time dates. It's just, was this person sane? Is this person like, let me Google you, and which was fun. This person has ended up being almost like a sister to me in terms of our conversations, in terms of the support that we have. We both tried for our second child using the same donor around the same time, and we ebbed and flowed and leaned in. And I found that I am really looking forward to growing the relationship with our children and these kids, and which kind of leads into your second book, which is Random Families. And so I'd like to hear a little bit more about what you found through your research and through writing of the second book.
We get a lot of questions related to the outcomes for donor-conceived children. And first of all, I think part of the issue is that we only interviewed in that book families in which the parents had told the child that they were donor conceived. So when you hear about, I'm constantly asked about these angry children and what's all that about. And I think that's really parents who keep secrets and don't tell their kids about whatever the route was that was taken. And this is most evident on some of the websites I belong to, where adults discover that their father or their mother is not biologically related to them, often through 23andMe or whatever. It's, oh my goodness, this was never told to me by anyone. So one of the things that I learned about the kids themselves is, being donor conceived is part of the fabric of their lives because their parents told them from young ages on, but they still face challenges. For example, what's a donor? That word, you have a donor, you don't have a dad. What does that mean? Donor is a hollow concept, and parents and children co-construct who that person is, which is interesting. And it's, what do you then tell your friends about where your dad is? And kids do have these narratives around this that makes it be a kind of a Disney story. Shitty things happen to lots of people, or things happen this way. I'm very loved. My mom is very loved. And some nice guy helped my mom by putting a seed into a bank, and my mom was able to use that seed. Mm-hmm. So on early ages on, so kids want to be able to identify with who that person is. And one of the things that donor siblings do, or kids who share the same sperm donor, is that they give kids a way to identify with one another. And they've created, as you're talking about, some great friendships for families themselves who meet regularly. It's like a community that's being formed. It's like, how do we expand kinship in new and exciting ways, even though they may not be legally or even sometimes socially recognized? But something else that I think, and then I'll stop talking, this is interesting, is that kids love the shock and the drama of telling a new teacher or a friend that they have 10 siblings. Yeah. So I just want to say one thing about that great story. It's interesting, that's one of the things that emerged out of the pandemic, because you got to see what's really happening in real time with your kid and what they really are saying.
Yeah.
It's like, for kids, it's a fact. it doesn't have the cultural and social implications that adults attach to saying, oh, this person has 10 donor siblings.
So I will add to that. I had to back my daughter up. SMCing is all different, and how our little people tell their stories is different. So my daughter, her first telling of the story was when she was 4 and in preschool, and the kids were going around talking about their family. And so Noelle came around and said, I have a donor. And so the teacher brushed her off, like, no, you don't have a donor. And at the end of the day, in talking through her day, we talked through what happened. And so this came up. And I was like, oh, okay, didn't react to it. So then wrote her teachers and the director of the preschool. I said, this is Noelle's story. Here's what you can do to support her in telling her story. Because then I had to give them the backstory. I had to say, Noelle is donor conceived. So she does not have a social dad. She actually has a donor that we identify in our home as the donor. And so I had to first educate the teachers and then tell them how they can support her in telling her narrative. And from that point forward, that was her first foray. But I will tell you, when you enter the school system, all of the rules go out the window. And so that's why it's like, you want to be the parent, you want to be the one who initiates that narrative. Like you said, the children that are grounded in their story, it's because it is a fact of their life and has always been a fact. So there is nothing missing. SMC families are complete. And then now when you enter the school system, you have to then prepare the teachers and how they can support these kids, because it's all everything. And you know, there are some parents in traditional families who are cringing, like, this is blasphemy. They should. And my attitude has changed on that just a little bit, because not everyone gets the proper training and a lot of things are happening at rapid pace. So what I will say is that I handle my schools and the doctors and all those different situations the same way I handle my family. When you tell your family that you're an SMC, you got to give them a beat to absorb it. What does that mean? And open up the space to ask their questions and then move on. So one of the things I did in the email is that I could provide you with the Todd Parr storybook about different families and different things like that. And but after that point, they handled it with grace. They never made a misstep after that. But I think I'm trying to navigate the world with the more fluidity in terms of how these happen, because there's going to be situations. My daughter was in an elevator and she said, Mommy, how come that man has a dress on? And again, I had to try not to react. And then I had just had to let her speak her truth and say, dresses, anybody can wear dresses, man, women, non-binary people. And I have to use actual language for her, because I'm also learning language with her. And but you hit on the key thing. I can't react from, oh my gosh, I'm so embarrassed that you said this thing. Yeah. Adult should be able to say, I'm an adult, here's a kid, and here's a teachable moment for that kid.
I just wanted to say, I just love that story. The real critical issue is we don't have the language. Schools are not, teachers are not given that language. And that's partially, in random families, partially what we're talking about a lot is what language people use and how that language changes. And the idea that a donor's hollow concept permeates both the school, the kids, the teacher. I love what you did. And I love how then the school picked up on it, 1, 2, 3, once you stepped in and said, this is my kid's truth. And this is the truth. So go ahead. I'm sorry. But I would say to you, so here's what's interesting. In the single mother's book in particular, and I have others that come out of the random families book that we really didn't write up in that particular narrative, but there are a couple of things. A lot of women do start out saying, I really want a known donor because I want a face to show my child. And this was in some ways before you did, there are pictures on the bank site that you can show your kid. A lot of that didn't work out for various reasons. A guy says, I'm willing to be a donor, but what about my mother? I really want her to be a grandmother, blah, 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 blah. I really want to be able to say what school the kids go to. I really want more contact. So for a lot of women, they backed off and they said, listen, this is not going to work out. I don't want that person involved in those ways in my kid's life. Now, from the kid's perspective, those who have known donors don't imagine the donor in the same ways that those who have sperm bank donors do, because there's a person there. The mom can say, here's this person, whether it's an egg or sperm donor, but here's this person. You share the genetic material with them, and the kid has a face to that person. Mm-hmm. Whereas for those kids whose mom chose to go the commercial route, they are more likely to then co-produce that donor. Mm. Okay, terrific question. I'm glad that you returned to that. In the 70-08ers who we feature in Random Families, it turns out, so these are all kids that were interviewed as teenagers. And then I've come back to that group. Most recently, I had coffee with them. This doesn't appear in the book, so this is fun information. Oh. And they actually did find this anonymous donor, okay, which is a whole other story. But I'm having coffee with a bunch of them. And I said, when we interviewed you when you were like 15 to 17, 18 year olds, most of you, a third of you said you didn't want to meet the donor. A third of you said you definitely really wanted to meet the donor, but he had rights to remain anonymous. But a third of you actually said, I'm on the fence. I said, what happened and how did you deal with different responses within the network? Because the kids were all close or they were all in contact with one another. So they said that they were very sensitive to the fact that within the group, there were differing opinions about what they wanted to know. Mm-hmm. So only a third of them approximately have met that particular donor. Those who didn't want to know did want some medical updates and that kind of information. And it's very random as to whether or not they had a mom family, a two-mom family, a mom and a dad, especially the kids who were ambivalent and on the fence. They said this wasn't important to their lives to know that person necessarily. They had a whole life. They had a whole family. Mm-hmm. And this was somebody who donated sperm and they loved the donor siblings more, interestingly mm-hmm. enough. And that was what was really important to them about having this paternal kin, in quotes, than in fact meeting the donor. So they all weren't gung-ho to meet the donor. The couple that did said that it was really wonderful to get those updates. And what they really wanted to know was the donor profile is a static piece of paper. And really what they wanted to know was, first of all, did that person ever think about me? Which is an interesting point. And then they wanted to be able to have coffee with that person, and they wanted to be able to find out if that person had achieved whatever it was they wrote on the donor profile. I'm going to get a graduate degree. I'm going to become a soccer famous player. I want to be a filmmaker, whatever it was. They wanted to know what happened in somebody's life, which is why I love to go back to the people I've interviewed and continue to interview them over time, because as a researcher and as a kid, that profile is no different. It's the static piece of paper. And you want to know what happened to that individual who you now realize gave sperm, let's say at age, I don't know, 23, what happened to that person? The other point I want to make is very few of these kids saw that person as a dad. They saw that person as a genetic parent, which is very different. So they weren't looking for a dad. By age 18, they're not looking in the same ways for an embrace of that nature, which I also think is really important, because the kids flip back and forth with that language of, I have a dad, I have a sperm donor, they flip back my father. And what they're talking about is a genetic person, right, which is important for certain things, but not always for everything. And particularly that person wasn't there for all the great milestones in your life and the memory making and everything else. But that person has made a promise to a bank to show up if they are identity released. What's interesting is these guys do show up in a way that I would have been really surprised at. They aren't the deadbeat dads.
It's general across the board. It's balancing expectations, right? And so you're trying to mitigate for all of the things that could potentially happen. Maybe the donor is no longer alive, or maybe the donor meets you and it's just like, yeah, let's go for coffee once a month and let's do this. So you really don't know what another person is going to do in all of this. And so it's just like balancing the expectations. You want to be truthful and honest. But for me, I try not to build up this person for anything more than it was, than a genetic contribution to your genetic makeup, and kind of, and then follow my kids' lead. I don't know what they're going to say either. They're little people that factor into this too. Yeah.
Okay. What I just want to say though, that's what's really interesting to me as well, is women who find these donors ahead of time. Mm-hmm. And the question becomes that in some ways, anonymity can't be guaranteed for donors today. Yeah. And more, it may be that we shift to a system that certain countries already have in place, which is if a donor wants to meet the child and the child's parents at younger ages than age 18, which is the legal age, that may in fact be happening. But what I have is examples, many of them, of mothers in particular who found the donors. and they don't tell the donors, but they sleuth them or they watch them on Facebook because it's the same thing. It's an expensive package. And if you have an expensive package that you're sending, you're going to put a tracker on it. So if you think about the sperm banks that you went to, on those banks, there's a sibling registry. While I don't have this in this research, the kids that the donor is raising tend not to have relationships with the donor siblings. Mm-hmm. And it's two different groups, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. Though I do have in random families, a sperm donor who showed up early and for the first meeting took his daughter to that meeting. Mm-hmm. Which has a number of implications, but she, first of all, wanted to know and wanted to meet the kids, but he was also making a point to the group saying, this is my, and they, the kids interpreted it as him saying to them, this is my real child, which is a terrible way to think about that. It is the kid he's raising.
It is all very interesting. And we can talk about this for hours, right? Because it all depends on how those expectations were set for that man's family, what he intended to do when he brought his biological child to the meeting. And so there are so many different aspects of this. And I think for me, the most healthy thing is to just be led by the kids and have healthy boundaries. Because when these men donate, it is a tissue donation. And I think if you think of it as anything more than that, without permission to think of it as anything more than that, then you get yourselves into troubled waters. I'm the kid. I think I told you, I'm the kid who would not have eaten the marshmallow. I am the rules girl until the rules no longer work for me. And I bury Pandora's box in the backyard and grow an apple tree on top of it. I'm not touching it because it really is only a teeny part of my story. And it's a teeny, I think it's a teeny part of my children's story, but it could be a bigger part of their story. And I want them to flourish and blossom in whatever that story is going to be for them.
First of all, it's tough to listen to the ways in which race becomes constructed. And as a researcher, you have to step back and say, look, I want to understand their story from their perspective, and I want to be able to make sense of it. And what's most interesting to me is that from a biological perspective, there are no races, but race is a real cultural, political, and economic concern in our society. And Rebecca, who's the woman I'm talking about there, her parents were disappointed because they did not think a Black baby would fit in within their family, within the extended family. And remember, the families are in some ways very conservative institutions where fit, which is about visual representation, is a really critical piece of this. And what the adoption chapter does is it shows the glaring ways in which is a much more visible idea than even donor use in some ways. And Rebecca's family was all white. And that's a really important fact for me. There were no people of color in their family at large, and they worried about whether they could love a baby who was not white or like them, is how I would put it. So I give Rebecca credit for going ahead with adoption because she really wanted an infant that came without a history of whatever. And she also wanted a child who was not from an international country. I don't even know if she could have afforded that. It's unclear to me, but she wanted to adopt domestically. And she was there at the birth of that child, actually one of those women who put in a picture book. And the teen mom, who is African-American, and the birth parents both said, this is the person we would like to adopt this child. And after the child was born, Rebecca went to pick up the child, but she didn't go back directly to her hometown in Boston. But what she did was she went to the birth mom's house and met the birth father and the extended family, all of whom were identified as African-American. Now, what's also interesting is that this was an open adoption. And when her baby was a young teenager, they reconnected with the birth mom because Rebecca felt that knowing her and having a relationship with her was important. So while I have to say it made me cringe over the beginning of the story with her parents objecting and them giving her money and then saying, you know, it shouldn't be a Black baby and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. As Rebecca's story unfolds, she did what she wanted to do, even though her parents weren't happy. So they had to come to respect Rebecca and wonder about these parents who said, oh, it's all fine and we'll just embrace the child, blah, blah, blah. So in some ways, as the story unfolds around her life, you get a very different sense about how those relationships develop. And for Rebecca, part of the concern becomes, how do I find a space in which my daughter's identity can be primary, because spaces tend to be divided so much. And so that's another issue that I explore somewhat in that chapter as well, this idea of Black and white spaces or Asian and white spaces, and how do women who adopt bridge those, also, I think, important. So I think the issue of race is incredibly sensitive when it comes to commercial donors, first of all. We did ask in these studies, how did you choose a donor, which was a very neutral question. I didn't know how people would respond, but you know how you have those filtering abilities on those websites?
Yes.
So the women we interviewed, or the parents we interviewed who were raising children of another race, are oftentimes two-parent families, first of all, among white families, which one is white, one isn't white. So they're going to match the donor to the other person. But let's just talk about single mothers, because they're somewhat different in many ways. And I'm still trying to puzzle through this topic, which I think is really important, which is that white women unapologetically select white donors. And how do they measure whiteness? They say that they use ethnicity as a guide. The donor is of Swiss ancestry, German ancestry, whatever. You can filter all this stuff, as you all know. But women who identified as either Black, African-American, Caribbean-American usually found it more difficult to find a donor who was of the same ethnic background. And so they were more likely to look for features that were in their extended families. Now, they also made statements like, there are white women in my family, there are biracial individuals in my family, this one married that one married the other one. There was a greater diversity within those families around skin tones, around race, around however you want to identify those factors. So I don't think race is a privilege, which is what I once thought. Are you choosing a lighter donor to privilege your child? I don't think it's that at all, because in fact, what women of color said was really no different than the white women, which was that I wanted to balance height, which is a privilege, all right? If I'm a short donor, I want a tall donor. I cared about health. Health was a big one. And I cared about identity release among the younger women I've interviewed. So in fact, those filters become the same. It's around the issue of skin tones or facial features that there's this matching that goes on. Because you want to be able to, again, I'm saying families are conservative for everyone. You want to be able to match something about that child to other members of your family and to yourself.
And I think in both communities I've heard, I think it is seen to some degree as a privilege, because there is the fetishization of this child is beautiful. I've heard that in both the Black SMC spaces and in the white SMC spaces, a lot in the white SMC spaces, like, this child is beautiful. I get to pick a donor. Why can't I pick my child's features? But I also give weight to the fit aspect, because a lot of the younger SMCs who will use a donor of a different race, and I say younger because I think generationally, this next generation from my generation are more open to dating interracially and across color lines. They will say, I have a lot of biracial people in my family. And so when I have this baby, is not coming into a space that is homogenous in terms of its ethnic makeup or it's all Black. So then I'm going to have a biracial your baby come and fit in and stand out like a sore thumb. They're saying essentially what was the opposite of what the adoptive mom was saying. We do want my kid to fit. What that fit looks like is different, but it's still the same. I want my kid to fit. And then just to put a period on that story, for me, I had to choose donors twice. My kids have different donors. And I really was intentional about picking for my first. I wanted the height. I wanted hair that was textured and can be braided into a cornrow without any fuss or muss, because that's part of my ethnic culture. I was looking for a Black donor, could not find a Black donor. There were like two that were open ID. And I was thinking, like, that limits the dating pool for my kids. So let me go across the color spectrum. So where you say white women are looking at ethnic makeup like Swiss or Eastern European, I was looking across the color spectrum, right? So ethnicity didn't matter to me. Once I could not get a Black donor, I was like, okay, I want my kid to look like they match me, right? So I went across the brown spectrum. And then when I tried for my second, I wanted my two daughters to match, right? And so then again, I went with the brown spectrum, but then I also needed to factor in blood type. And so it got a bit more complex. So I just wanted to put a period on that to help answer that question for you from this one Black person's perspective.
Yeah. So at the moment, I'm debating what I'm doing in the future, but I would love, love, love just to do a study that had MoCA SMCs as centering their voices. Because if you think about the research from the very beginning of this conversation, much less of it had women of color in it in general. And I think that they tell a very different narrative in some ways. And in some ways, it's the same narrative, but we need to have those voices there. Because I think going to sperm banks or adopting, but particularly sperm banks themselves, is going to be, it is the wave of the future. And I end the Single by Chance, Mothers by Choice book that way. And I think more and more younger women will do that. But they need to see themselves in the literature or in these books. Yep. And they need to see the differences that occur and why, let's say, filtering occurs this way or that way, or how banks themselves have a cutoff on education or on height that may, in fact, be problematic for certain ethnic or racial groups in America. So there's like a lot to be done in this space as more and more women come forward who are single mothers by choice, who are of color. So I'm hoping in the future to maybe get the two of you to help me to do some work around that topic.
Yes,
and to try to puzzle out what's similar, what's different, and how we then use that to constitute this idea of family in the future and going forward. And I think that's going to change in many ways for all of us, regardless of how you identify and what race you are. I loved meeting you all. And I know this was just so much fun to think about and try to puzzle through. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. And I look forward to staying in touch.
Full Pod, thank you so much for taking the time to listen. If you like what you've heard, please share this podcast with your girlfriends. And I'd love to hear your thoughts about the topics covered in this episode. So email me at mochasmc@gmail.com. If you found value in the topics covered, consider making a donation using the link in the show notes below. Till next time, Pod. Bye now.